Then why did you have to work as a track laborer?
Because no money earned in the valley is ever to be spent outside.
Where did you get this equipment?
I designed it. Andrew Stockton's foundry made it.
He pointed to an unobtrusive object the size of a radio cabinet in a corner of the room.
There's the motor you wanted.
And chuckled at her gasp, at the involuntary jolt that threw her forward.
Don't bother studying it. You won't give it away to them now.
She was staring at the shining metal cylinders and the glistening coils of wire that suggested the rusted shape resting like a sacred relic in a glass coffin in a vault of the Taggart terminal.
It supplies my own electric power for the laboratory, he said. No one has had to wonder why a track laborer is using such exorbitant amounts of electricity.
But if they ever found this place... He gave an odd, brief chuckle.
They won't.
How long have you been... She stopped. This time she did not gasp. The sight confronting her could not be greeted by anything except a moment of total inner stillness. On the wall, behind a row of machinery, she saw a picture, cut out of a newspaper. A picture of her, in slacks and shirt, standing by the side of the engine at the opening of the John Galt line, her head lifted, her smile holding the context, the meaning, and the sunlight of that day. A moan was her only answer as she turned to him, but the look on his face matched hers in the picture.
I was the symbol of what you wanted to destroy in the world, he said, but you were my symbol of what I wanted to achieve.
He pointed at the picture.
This is how men expect to feel about their life once or twice as an exception in the course of their lifetime. But I... This is what I chose as the constant and normal.
The look on his face, the serene intensity of his eyes and of his mind, made it real to her now in this moment's full context, in this city. When he kissed her, she knew that their arms holding each other were holding their greatest triumph, that this was the reality untouched by pain or fear, the reality of Halley's fifth concerto. This was the reward they had wanted, fought for, and won. The doorbell rang. Her first reaction was to draw back, his to hold her closer and longer. When he raised his head, he was smiling. He said only,
"Now is the time not to be afraid."
She followed him back to the garret. She heard the door of the laboratory clicking locked behind them. He held her coat for her silently. He waited until she had tied its belt and put on her hat. Then he walked to the entrance door and opened it. Three of the four men who entered were muscular figures in military uniforms, each with two guns on his hips, with broad faces devoid of shape and eyes untouched by perception. The fourth, their leader, was a frail civilian with an expensive overcoat, a neat mustache, pale blue eyes, and the manner of an intellectual of the public relations species. He blinked at Galt, at the room, made a step forward, stopped, made another step and stopped.
Yes, said Galt.
Are you John Galt? He asked too loudly.
That's my name.
Are you the John Galt?
Which one?
Did you speak on the radio?
When?
Don't let him fool you.
The metallic voice was Dagny's, and it was addressed to the leader.
He is John Galt. I shall report the proof to headquarters. You may proceed.
Galt turned to her as to a stranger. Will you tell me now just who you are and what it was that you wanted here?
Her face was as blank as the faces of the soldiers. My name is Dagny Taggart. I wanted to convince myself that you are the man whom the country is seeking. He turned to the leader.
All right, he said. I am John Galt. But if you want me to answer you at all, keep your stool pigeon, he pointed at Dagny, away from me.
Mr. Galt, cried the leader with the sound of an enormous joviality. It is an honor to meet you, an honor and a privilege. Please, Mr. Galt, don't misunderstand us. We're ready to grant you your wishes. No, of course, you don't have to deal with Miss Taggart if you prefer not to. Miss Taggart was only trying to do her patriotic duty, but
I said keep her away from me.
We're not your enemies, Mr. Galt. I assure you, we're not your enemies.
He turned to Dagny.
Miss Taggart, you have performed an invaluable service to the people. You have earned the highest form of public gratitude. Permit us to take over from here on.
The soothing motions of his hands were urging her to stand back,
to keep out of Galt's sight.
"Now, what do you want?" asked Galt.
"The nation is waiting for you, Mr. Galt. All we want is a chance to dispel misapprehensions. Just a chance to cooperate with you."
His gloved hand was waving a signal to his three men. The floorboards creaked as the men proceeded silently to the task of opening drawers and closets. They were searching the room.
"The spirit of the nation will revive tomorrow morning, Mr. Galt, when they hear that you have been found."
"What do you want?"
"Just to greet you in the name of the people."
"Am I under arrest?"
"Why think in such old-fashioned terms? Our job is only to escort you safely to the top councils of the national leadership, where your presence is urgently needed."
He paused, but got no answer.
"The country's top leaders desire to confer with you, just to confer, and to reach a friendly understanding."
The soldiers were finding nothing but garments and kitchen utensils. There were no letters, no books, not even a newspaper, as if the room were the habitation of an illiterate.
"Our objective is only to assist you to assume your rightful place in society, Mr. Galt. You do not seem to realize your own public value."
"I do."
"We are here only to protect you."
"Locked," declared a soldier, banging his fist against the laboratory door.
The leader assumed an ingratiating smile.
"What is behind that door, Mr. Galt?"
"Private property."
"Would you open it, please?"
"No."
The leader spread his hands out in a gesture of pained helplessness.
"Unfortunately, my hands are tied. Orders, you know. We have to enter that room."
"Enter it."
"It's only a formality, a mere formality. There's no reason why things should not be handled amicably. Won't you please cooperate?"
I said, "No."
"I'm sure you wouldn't want us to resort to any unnecessary means."
He got no answer.
"We have the authority to break that door down, you know, but of course we wouldn't want to do it."
He waited, but got no answer.
"Force that lock," he snapped to the soldier.
Dagny glanced at Galt's face. He stood impassively, his head held level. She saw the undisturbed lines of his profile, his eyes directed at the door. The lock was a small square plate of polished copper, without keyhole or fixtures. The silence and the sudden immobility of the three brutes were involuntary, while the burglar's tools in the hands of the fourth went grating cautiously against the wood of the door. The wood gave way easily, and small chips fell down, their thuds magnified by the silence, into the rattle of a distant gun. When the burglar's jimmy attacked the copper plate, they heard a faint rustle behind the door, no louder than the sigh of a weary mind. In another minute the lock fell out, and the door shuddered forward the width of an inch. The soldier jumped back. The leader approached, his steps irregular like hiccups, and threw the door open. They faced a black hole of unknown content, an unrelieved darkness. They glanced at one another, and at Galt. He did not move. He stood looking at the darkness. Dagny followed them when they stepped over the threshold, preceded by the beams of their flashlights. The space beyond was a long shell of metal, empty but for heavy drifts of dust on the floor, an odd grayish-white dust that seemed to belong among ruins undisturbed for centuries. The room looked dead, like an empty skull. She turned away, not to let them see in her face the scream of the knowledge of what that dust had been a few minutes ago. "Don't try to open that door," he had said to her at the entrance to the powerhouse of Atlantis. "If you tried to break it down, the machinery inside would collapse into rubble long before the door would give way." "Don't try to open that door," she was thinking, but knew that what she was now seeing was the visual form of the statement. "Don't try to force a mind." The men backed out in silence and went on backing toward the exit door, then stopped uncertainly one after another at random points of the garret, as if abandoned by a receding tide.
"Well," said Galt, reaching for his overcoat and turning to the leader. "Let's go."
Three floors of the Wayne Falkland Hotel had been evacuated and transformed into an armed camp. Guards with machine guns stood at every turn of the long velvet-carpeted corridors. Sentinels with bayonets stood on the landings of the fire stairways. The elevator doors of the 59th, 60th, and 61st floors were padlocked. A single door and one elevator were left as sole means of access, guarded by soldiers in full battle regalia.
Peculiar-looking men loitered in the lobbies, restaurants, and shops of the ground floor. Their clothes were too new and too expensive, in unsuccessful imitation of the hotel's usual patrons. A camouflage, impaired by the fact that the clothes were badly fitted to their wearers' husky figures, and were further distorted by bulges in places where the garments of businessmen have no cause to bulge. But the garments of gunmen have. Groups of guards with Tommy guns were posted at every entrance and exit of the hotel, as well as at strategic windows of the adjoining streets. In the center of this camp, on the 60th floor, in what was known as the Royal Suite of the Wayne Falkland Hotel, amidst satin drapes, crystal candelabra, and sculptured garlands of flowers, John Galt, dressed in slacks and shirt, sat in a brocaded armchair, one leg stretched out on a velvet hassock, his hands crossed behind his head looking at the ceiling. This was the posture in which Mr. Thompson found him, when the four guards, who had stood outside the door of the royal suite since 5 a.m., opened it at 11 a.m. to admit Mr. Thompson, and locked it again. Mr. Thompson experienced a brief flash of uneasiness when the click of the lock cut off his escape, and left him alone with the prisoner. But he remembered the newspaper headlines and the radio voices, which had been announcing to the country since dawn, "John Galt is found. John Galt is in New York. John Galt has joined the people's cause. John Galt is in conference with the country's leaders working for a speedy solution of all our problems." And he made himself feel that he believed it. "Well, well, well," he said brightly, marching up to the armchair. "So you're the young fellow who started all the trouble." "Oh," he said suddenly as he got a closer look at the dark green eyes watching him. "Well, I'm tickled pink to meet you, Mr. Galt. Just tickled pink," he added. "I'm Mr. Thompson, you know."
"How do you do?" said Galt.
Mr. Thompson thudded down on a chair, the brusqueness of the movement suggesting a cheerily businesslike attitude.
"Now, don't go imagining that you're under arrest or some such nonsense." He pointed at the room. "This is no jail, as you can see. You can see that we'll treat you right. You're a big person, a very big person, and we know it. Just make yourself at home. Ask for anything you please. Fire any flunky that doesn't obey you. And if you take a dislike to any of the army boys outside, just breathe the word, and we'll send another one to replace him."
He paused expectantly. He received no answer.
"The only reason we brought you here is just that we wanted to talk to you. We wouldn't have done it this way, but you left us no choice. You kept hiding. And all we wanted was a chance to tell you that you got us all wrong."
He spread his hands out, palms up, with a disarming smile. Galt's eyes were watching him without answer.
"That was some speech you made. Boy, are you an orator. You've done something to the country. I don't know what or why, but you have. People seem to want something you've got. But you thought we'd be dead set against it? That's where you're wrong. We're not. Personally, I think there was plenty in that speech that made sense. Yes, sir, I do. Of course, I don't agree with every word you said, but what the hell, you don't expect us to agree with everything, do you? Differences of opinion. That's what makes horse racing. Me, I'm always willing to change my mind. I'm open to any argument."
He leaned forward invitingly. He obtained no answer.
"The world is in a hell of a mess, just as you said. There I agree with you. We have a point in common. We can start from that. Something's got to be done about it. All I wanted was..."
"Look," he cried suddenly, "why don't you let me talk to you?"
"You are talking to me."
Well, you know what I mean."
"Fully."
"Well?" "Well, what have you got to say?"
"Nothing."
"Huh?"
"Nothing."
"Oh, come now.
I didn't seek to talk to you."
But look, we have things to discuss."
"I haven't."
"Look," said Mr. Thompson after a pause, "you're a man of action, a practical man. Boy, are you a practical man. Whatever else I don't quite get about you, I'm sure of that. Now, aren't you?"
"Practical?"
"Yes." "Well, so am I. We can talk straight. We can put our cards on the table. Whatever it is you're after, I'm offering you a deal."
"I'm always open to a deal."
"I knew it!"
cried Mr. Thompson triumphantly, slamming his fist down on his own knee. "I told them so, all those fool intellectual theorizers like Wesley. I'm always open to a deal with anyone who has a value to offer me."
Mr. Thompson could not tell what made him miss a beat before he answered.
"Well, write your own ticket, brother. Write your own ticket. What have you got to offer me?"
"Why, anything."
"Such as?"
"Anything you name. Have you heard our shortwave broadcasts to you?"
"Yes."
"We said we'll meet your terms. Any terms."
"We meant it." "Have you heard me say on the radio that I have no terms to bargain about?" "I meant it."
"Oh, but look, you misunderstood us. You thought we'd fight you, but we won't. We're not that rigid. We're willing to consider any idea. Why didn't you answer our calls and come to a conference?"
"Why should I?"
Because we wanted to speak to you in the name of the country."
"I don't recognize your right to speak in the name of the country."
"Now, look here, I'm not used to—" "Well, okay. Won't you just give me a hearing? Won't you listen?"
"I'm listening."
"The country is in a terrible state. People are starving and giving up. The economy is falling to pieces. Nobody's producing any longer. We don't know what to do about it. You do. You know how to make things work. Okay, we're ready to give in. We want you to tell us what to do."
"I told you what to do."
"What?"
"Get out of the way."
"That's impossible. That's fantastic. That's out of the question."
"You see, I told you we had nothing to discuss."
"Now wait, wait. Don't go to extremes. There's always a middle ground. You can't have everything. People aren't ready for it. You can't expect us to ditch the machinery of state. We've got to preserve the system. But we're willing to amend it. We'll modify it any way you wish. We're not stubborn theoretical dogmatists. We're flexible. We'll do anything you say. We'll give you a free hand. We'll cooperate. We'll compromise. We'll split 50-50. We'll keep the sphere of politics and give you total power over the sphere of economics. We'll turn the production of the country over to you. We'll make you a present of the entire economy. You'll run it any way you wish. You'll give the orders, you'll issue the directives, and you'll have the organized power of the state at your command to enforce your decisions. We'll stand ready to obey you, all of us, from me on down. In the field of production, we'll do whatever you say. You'll be the economic dictator of the nation."
Galt burst out laughing. It was the simple amusement of the laughter that shocked Mr. Thompson.
"What's the matter with you?"
"So that's your idea of a compromise, is it?"
Don't sit there grinning like that. I don't think you understood me. I'm offering you Wesley Mooch's job, and there's nothing bigger that anyone could offer you. You'll be free to do anything you wish. If you don't like controls, repeal them. If you want higher profits and lower wages, decree them. If you want special privileges for the big tycoons, grant them. If you don't like labor unions, dissolve them. If you want a free economy, order people to be free. Play it any way you please, but get things going. Get the country organized. Make people work again. Make them produce. Bring back your own men, the men of brains. Lead us to a peaceful, scientific, industrial age and to prosperity.
At the point of a gun?
Now look, Now what's so damn funny about it?
Will you tell me just one thing? If you're able to pretend that you haven't heard a word I said on the radio, what makes you think I'd be willing to pretend that I haven't said it?
I don't know what you mean.
Skip it. It was just a rhetorical question. The first part of it answers the second.
Huh?
I don't play your kind of games, brother. If you want a translation...
Do you mean that you're refusing my offer?
I am.
But why?
It took me 3 hours on the radio to tell you why.
Oh, that's just theory. I'm talking business. I'm offering you the greatest job in the world. Will you tell me what's wrong with it?
What I told you, in 3 hours, was that it won't work.
You can make it work.
How?
Mr. Thompson spread his hands out.
I don't know. If I did, I wouldn't come to you. It's for you to figure out. You're the industrial genius. You can solve anything.
I said it can't be done.
You could do it?
How?
Somehow.
He heard Galt's chuckle and added,
Why not? Just tell me, why not?
Okay, I'll tell you. You want me to be the economic dictator?
Yes.
And you'll obey any order I give?
Implicitly.
Then start by abolishing all income taxes.
Oh, no, screamed Mr. Thompson, leaping to his feet. We couldn't do that. That's not the field of production. That's the field of distribution. How would we pay government employees?
Fire your government employees.
Oh, no, that's politics. That's not economics. You can't interfere with politics. You can't have everything.
Galt crossed his legs on the hassock, stretching himself more comfortably in the brocaded armchair. Want to continue the discussion, or do you get the point?
I only... He stopped.
Are you satisfied that I got the point?
Look, said Mr. Thompson placatingly, resuming the edge of his seat. I don't want to argue. I'm no good at debates. I'm a man of action. Time is short. All I know is that you've got a mind, just the sort of mind we need. You can do anything. You could make things work, if you wanted to.
All right, put it your own way. I don't want to. I don't want to be an economic dictator, not even long enough to issue that order for people to be free, which any rational human being would throw back in my face because he'd know that his rights are not to be held, given, or received by your permission or mine.
Tell me, said Mr. Thompson, looking at him reflectively. What is it you're after?
I told you on the radio.
I don't get it. You said that you're out for your own selfish interest, and that I can understand. But what can you possibly want in the future that you couldn't get right now from us, handed down to you on a platter? I thought you were an egoist and a practical man. I offer you a blank check on anything you wish, and you tell me that you don't want it.
Why? Because there are no funds behind your blank check.
What?
Because you have no value to offer me.
I can offer you anything you can ask. Just name it.
You name it.
Well, you talked a lot about wealth. If it's money that you want, you couldn't make in 3 lifetimes what I can hand over to you in a minute, this minute, cash on the barrel.
Want $1 billion? A cool, neat $1 billion? Which I'll have to produce for you to give me.
No, I mean straight out of the public treasury in fresh new bills, or
even in gold, if you prefer. What will it buy me?
Oh, look, when the country gets back on its feet.
When I put it back on its feet?
Well, if what you want is to run things your own way, if it's power that you're after, I'll guarantee you that every man, woman, and child in this country will obey your orders and do whatever you wish.
After I teach them to do it.
If you want anything for your own gang, for all those men who've disappeared, jobs, positions, authority, tax exemptions, any special favor at all, just name it and they'll get it.
After I bring them back.
Well, what on earth do you want?
What on earth do I need you for?
Huh?
What have you got to offer me that I couldn't get without you?
There was a different look in Mr. Thompson's eyes when he drew back, as if cornered, yet looked straight at Galt for the first time, and said slowly, Without me, you couldn't get out of this room right now.
Galt smiled.
True. You wouldn't be able to produce anything. You could be left here to starve.
True.
Well, don't you see?
The loudness of homey joviality came back into Mr. Thompson's voice, as if the hint given and received were now to be safely evaded by means of humor.
What I've got to offer you is your life.
It's not yours to offer, Mr. Thompson, said Galt softly. Something about his voice made Mr. Thompson jerk to glance at him, then jerk faster to look away. Galt's smile seemed almost gentle.
Now, said Galt, do you see what I mean when I said that a zero can't hold a mortgage over life? It's I who'd have to grant you that kind of mortgage, and I don't. The removal of a threat is not a payment. The negation of a negative is not a reward. The withdrawal of your armed hoodlums is not an incentive. The offer not to murder me is not of value.
Who said anything about murdering you? Who said anything about anything else? If you weren't holding me here at the point of a gun under threat of death, you wouldn't have a chance to speak to me at all. And that is as much as your guns can accomplish. I don't pay for the removal of threats. I don't buy my life from anyone.
That's not true,
said Mr. Thompson brightly. If you had a broken leg, you'd pay a doctor to set it.
Not if he was the one who broke it.
He smiled at Mr. Thompson's silence.
I'm a practical man, Mr. Thompson. I don't think it's practical to establish a person whose sole means of livelihood is the breaking of my bones. I don't think it's practical to support a protection racket.
Mr. Thompson looked thoughtful, then shook his head.
I don't think you're practical, he said. A practical man doesn't ignore the facts of reality. He doesn't waste his time wishing things to be different or trying to change them. He takes things as they are. We're holding you. It's a fact. Whether you like it or not, it's a fact. You should act accordingly.
I am.
What I mean is you should cooperate. You should recognize an existing situation, accept it, and adjust to it.
If you had blood poisoning, would you adjust to it or act to change it?
Oh, that's different. That's physical.
You mean physical facts are open to correction, but your whims are not?
Huh?
You mean physical nature can be adjusted to men, but your whims are above the laws of nature and men must adjust to you?
I mean that I hold the upper hand.
With a gun in it?
Oh, forget about guns.
I can't forget a fact of reality, Mr. Thompson. That would be impractical.
All right, then. I hold a gun. What are you going to do about it?
I'll act accordingly. I'll obey you.
What?
I'll do whatever you tell me to.
Do you mean it?
I mean it. Literally.
He saw the eagerness of Mr. Thompson's face ebb slowly under a look of bewilderment.
I will perform any motion you order me to perform. If you order me to move into the office of an economic dictator, I'll move into it. If you order me to sit at a desk, I will sit at it. If you order me to issue a directive, I will issue the directive you order me to issue.
Oh, but I don't know what directives to issue.
I don't either.
There was a long pause.
Well, said Galt, what are your orders?
I want you to save the economy of the country.
I don't know how to save it.
I want you to find a way.
I don't know how to find it.
I want you to think.
How will your gun make me do that, Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Thompson looked at him silently, and Galt saw in the tightened lips, in the jutting chin, in the narrowed eyes, the look of an adolescent bully about to utter that philosophical argument which is expressed by the sentence, "I'll bash your teeth in." Galt smiled, looking straight at him, as if hearing the unspoken sentence and underscoring it. Mr. Thompson looked away.
No, said Galt. You don't want me to think. When you force a man to act against his own choice and judgment, it's his thinking that you want him to suspend. You want him to become a robot. I shall comply.
Mr. Thompson sighed.
I don't get it,
he said in a tone of genuine helplessness.
Something's off, and I can't figure it out. Why should you ask for trouble? With a brain like yours, you can beat anybody. I'm no match for you, and you know it.
Why don't you pretend to join us, then gain control and outsmart me? For the same reason that makes you offer it. Because you'd win.
Huh?
Because it's the attempt of your betters to beat you on your terms that has allowed your kind to get away with it for centuries. Which one of us would succeed if I were to compete with you for control over your muscle men? Sure, I could pretend. And I wouldn't save your economy or your system. Nothing will save them now. But I'd perish. And what you'd win would be what you've always won in the past.
A postponement.
One more stay of execution for another year or month, bought at the price of whatever hope and effort might still be squeezed out of the best of the human remnants left around you, including me. That's all you're after. And that is the length of your range. A month? You'd settle for a week, on the unchallenged absolute that there will always be another victim to find. But you found your last victim, the one who refuses to play his historical part. The game is up, brother.
Oh, that's just theory,
snapped Mr. Thompson, a little too sharply. His eyes were roving about the room in the manner of a substitute for pacing. He glanced at the door, as if longing to escape.
You say that if we don't give up the system, we'll perish?
He asked.
Yes,